He is a great writer, a great speaker, best of all, a great person. He has written many books, New York Times bestsellers, Blue Like Jazz, A Million Miles in a Thousand Years, several others. He's the founder of the Mentoring Project. He is Mr. Don Miller.
Thanks, you guys. Thanks, Michael. Hi. It's great to be with you. I'm going to set this up. I don't usually just carry this for like a security blanket, but I actually have my notes in it. And it's good to be here. I've been staying up on the lake here for the last few days. Rather than flying back home to Portland, I stayed here and got some writing done, and I've enjoyed the beauty of North Carolina and all the Portland rain that you had for me. Appreciate that. And it's been really good. To try to compare like Portland culture to Charlotte culture is, I mean, Portland is just another country. It's really weird that I'll go to like a restaurant and I'll be eating and then people will bow and pray at a table next to me. And I just want to go over and say, you don't do that in public, do you? Like, people will be offended if you do that. I live in a really unchurched culture. I mean, probably 2% of people in my city attend any kind of evangelical church. And faith is just, it's just a whole different ballgame. I can't explain it. You'd have to come and live there for a couple of years to figure it out. But I recently moved. I used to write at home, and I moved about 8 months ago into an office above a Vietnamese bistro. And so I was enjoying writing at home, and then I discovered I had a television, and I couldn't get work done anymore. And so I found this office, and it's basically an old house, you know, and I became really good friends with these people who run the coffee shop downstairs, and there's not any Christians. They're mostly Buddhists, and then one gal that I became good friends with named Johanna, she's an atheist. But I would stop and get my, you know, Vietnamese coffee, and I'm not a caffeine guy, I'm not a coffee guy. But it tastes like a milkshake. It's so good. And I didn't realize they're putting like 7 shots of cappuccino in each one of these. And so I'm just bouncing off the walls upstairs and coming down and chatting with everybody. What are you putting in this thing? What are you putting? Why does it taste like that? You know, those kinds of deals. Anyway, and then we all got to be friends. So this Christmas, you know, I had a big ugly sweater Christmas party at my place, and everybody came, and we just ended up becoming really good friends. And then pretty soon it started to happen that they would, you know, they would say, what do you do? And I'd say, I'm a writer. And then they Googled me or something like that. And I started getting these like weird looks as I would walk through. And I'm like, oh, they know that I'm a Christian now. This is where things get strange. And the reactions have been basically this. The reactions have been, how in the world could you possibly believe that? I mean, literally, like, how in the world can a guy who seems as normal and intelligent as you believe in this kind of ancient mythology? And then also, you know, to just sort of piggyback on Mike's talking about this, there's this idea of, and yet I'm looking for hope. And so multiple times I've gotten either a text message in the night, my phone will ding, and it's Joe, and she's saying, honestly, how could you possibly believe? I'm not even joking. Can you explain it to me at some point? And we, after this big Christmas party, a bunch of us ended up staying out all night just at the house, and I have a view out my window. I just sold my condo, so I have 20 more days to enjoy it. But out my window, I look at Mount Hood, 11,000 feet of Mount Hood, and the sun comes up on the other side of Mount Hood. And we stayed up all night, and we're watching the sunrise, and we've talked about Jesus off and on for the night, and, you know, we've had some beers. I don't know if that's a sin here. It depends where you go in the country. If it helps you, we had coffee. But we didn't, because it's not a sin there. It's a sin here, and that's in your Bible. But, you know, the conversation was open. It was really good. And then at one point, we're watching this stunning sunrise. I wish I had brought a picture of it. Watch this stunning sunrise. And I just looked over at Joe and I said, how could you not believe in God? How could you not? And she just kind of went, yeah, I can kind of see where you're coming from a little bit. But this desire for hope, right? But really, what are they saying, especially in Portland? What are they saying? They're saying, where is this Jesus? Like, where is he? Have you ever wondered that? I mean, wouldn't it be really great? And wouldn't it help you as a Christian leader, as somebody who works at a church and interacts with people regarding faith, if Jesus just came back maybe once every 5 years and did a press conference? Wouldn't it, to be honest, it would really help things out if he came back and he just said, hey, I exist. Then he did some magic tricks and he said, listen to the people who talk about me. Some of them don't listen at all. If they spray paint their hair and they have a television show, don't listen to them. But everybody else is fairly normal. And then, right, that would clarify a lot of things. But he doesn't do this. He doesn't. He's not here. He's not having a press conference. He's not doing these kind of shows that he did when he walked the earth. In fact, our narrative, our story, the Christian story, is actually quite mysterious. He comes like in this Christmas, you know, this typical sort of Christmas photo here on the first slide. They're going to have to do the slides sort of manually tonight, so it's going to take us a second. But he comes right in a manger. We just passed through this season. He spends about 32 or so years. He does only a few years of serious ministry kind of at the end of his life. So only about 3 years in the history of the world, Jesus is sort of proclaiming himself. Then he goes up in an ascension in the next slide, right? And he disappears and he's gone. And he leaves the rest of it sort of for us. And so what happens when Jesus goes? Well, Time magazine presents this idea that God is dead. And they just sort of parrot Nietzsche and say God is gone. Show the Time magazine cover, right? And so this is kind of the culture that we live within. They say Portland in the Pacific Northwest is about 25 years ahead of the rest of the country. So if that's true, in about 25 years, only about 2% of the people you know will attend any kind of church. Now, this doesn't mean that only 2% of the people know Jesus. A church is very different in the Pacific Northwest. By attending church, it doesn't mean that you're a Christian or you are or you aren't. It just means that you go to church and then you can have faith outside of church. It's not as big of a deal. But we live in this culture that people are assuming God is gone and God is dead. I have a friend named Kathy, who was struggling with her faith. She was asking some really tough questions. And in the midst of her struggle, she ended up in Rwanda on an unrelated trip with a group of people. And she was questioning, can God really exist? Can God really be there? She ends up in Rwanda. She ends up at the Rwandan Genocide Museum, where they have sort of created a memorial to the atrocities that took place there. And she ends up in this room. And she's looking at this rack of skulls that they've collected as a memorial to the people who lost their lives in this atrocity. And it really is the kind of perfect place, right, to say, see, God can't possibly exist. I mean, in the midst of this kind of hopelessness, in the midst of this kind of pain, what other evidence do we need to suggest that there is no God? This will do it. And in that place, she heard God say to her, Kathy, see what happens when I leave. See what happens when nobody brings the light. And it had the opposite effect on her. She realized that this is actually evidence that the presence of Jesus has left this place. That if Jesus were here, if people were civil, if people could get along, if people, and the kind of peace that Jesus brings, that perhaps none of this would happen. Where is Jesus? Is Jesus gone? Has Jesus left the earth? Well, Scripture would tell us that he hasn't. Look at these passages in Colossians, these passages from Paul. Where is Jesus? To whom God wanted to make known the glorious riches of this secret among the Gentiles, which is Christ in you, the hope of glory. Paul would tell us that Christ is actually in you. That every morning when your feet hit the ground, it's Christmas morning. Every morning when you get out of bed, it's Merry Christmas to everybody in your life. That Jesus actually decides to take up residency in you. Does he take up residency in a church? No. No, he does not take up residency in a church. You're his church. He takes up residency in you. So we could destroy this building and nothing sacred at all has been destroyed. No offense, because I know you guys have paid a lot of money for it. Don't destroy the building. No, he lives within you. And so we bring hope into the world because Christ is in us. Paul says, Him we proclaim, warning everyone and teaching everyone with all wisdom, that we may present everyone mature in Christ. For this I toil, struggling with all his energy, that he powerfully works in me. We see this incredibly close relationship. He continues in Colossians and Galatians. He says, here there is not Greek and Jew, circumcised and uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave, free, but Christ is in all, and Christ is all and in all. And then, of course, in Galatians, I have been crucified with Christ, and it is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life which I now live, I live in the flesh. I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me and delivered himself up for me. And so when we ask ourselves, where is hope in the world? It is wrong for us to look externally for that hope. Do you understand what I'm saying? I mean, when we look for hope in the world, we have this tendency to take somebody to church, right? Instead of taking Jesus to them within me. Every day when I go into the Vietnamese coffee shop, Jesus enters the coffee shop. That's crappy kind of pressure, let me tell you. It is. But this is, if they are going to see hope, if they are going to see a picture of Christ, they're going to have to see it in me. And what does this mean? Does this mean that I act really religious, or I hide my sin, right? So that I'm a really good sort of, poster boy for Jesus or religious culture? Absolutely not. That's a poster boy for inauthenticity and fear. What I have to do is bring myself, all of me. And confession is really helping people understand the difference between Jesus and me. So confession is incredibly important. There was an interior designer. I have this place that I just sold, but I've had it for years. And my real ministry is not writing or speaking. You probably don't know this because I never write about it or speak about it. But what I love to do is practice hospitality. As a bachelor, that's a weird gift, but I love doing it. So last year, I had over 100 overnight house guests. They are constantly coming through the house. And we have a crate of arrow beds, and there'll be I have these steel ceilings like this room, and I hang climbing beds for rope climbers from the raft. I mean, because these bands will come through, and there'll be like 10 really smelly hippies laying around my house after a gig, you know. And I just love it. I love ministering to these folks, and I have no idea why I started that story. Except to say that there was a point where it was just, this is really great. I love doing this. I love coming and talking, and it's fun. The crappy part is leaving, right? Where you come, I don't actually get to know you. We shake hands. We have 8 seconds of conversation. You tell me what beach you were on when you read my book, and I leave. This is the makings of a very lonely life, right? And I just got to this place where, like, I want to actually sit down and talk about Jesus for a long period of time with real people, like in my home. That, to me, is infinitely more fulfilling than any of this other stuff. And so writing and speaking is fundraising for the ministry that Jesus has me do, which is making potato salad in my house for hippies who come through. And what is Jesus doing within us? I mean, when we take Jesus as leaders, when you take Jesus into somebody's home, or when you take Jesus to Starbucks, or when you take Jesus into your office, what is Jesus doing? I love this icon. This is an icon I found. It's in a monastery in the Sinai Desert. And this icons are not weird or mysterious kind of things. Basically, icons came around before the printing press, and people would use them to teach doctrine or theology before people could read. So they have these sort of visual representations of theological ideas. If you look at the face of Jesus, I want to zoom in close here. I think it gives us a great picture of kind of how Jesus interacts with people. When you look at, the icon is designed so that when you look at Jesus' left eye, as we are looking at it, the left side, he is convicting you of your sin. That there is this part of Jesus, when Jesus comes into our souls, when Jesus comes into our communities, and even when Jesus comes into your friendship through you, that there is a reality, almost like a doctor saying, hey, I got bad news. You got cancer, right? we often lose this part of the presence of Christ, that Christ comes to do two things, right? He divides. He divides families. And he's come with a sword. And he's the Prince of Peace. That's confusing, isn't it? I mean, I'm the Prince of Peace. He's carrying a weapon. That's just like, hold on. I think you got the wrong title. Yeah, and then if you look at the right side of Jesus' face, the eye is designed, the painter has designed the eye to represent this forgiveness and the grace that Christ has. He convicts us of our sin, and then he shows us grace. So why is it that our culture has so much trouble seeing God? Why is it that popular American culture does not see Jesus? I think there are a couple reasons. One is, Jesus does not look like evangelical culture in America wants him to look. He just doesn't. I mean, if we were to create a Jesus that would build our churches and represent our community, he would not look like the actual Jesus, would he? We think about the people who we like to represent us as Christians. You know, who are they? I mean, even our politicians, they need to be good-looking. They need to be moral, right? They need to be these sort of perfect characters. They need to speak well. What does Scripture say about who Jesus was when he walked the earth? Yeah, Isaiah says this. He grew up like a young plant and like a root out of the dry ground. He had no form or comeliness that we should look upon him, and no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by all, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and as one from whom men hide their faces. He was despised, and we esteemed him not. Is that the candidate that you're looking for? Is this going to help you in your ministry? Yet this is really who Jesus is. But what we often do as leaders is we come in and rather than say, hey, for those who are hopeless, here is one who is like you. Here is one who sees you. Here is one who does not come to you with conditions saying, I will only associate with you if you are successful or if you're attractive or these kinds of ideas. That Jesus actually comes to the very least of these. Why? Because Jesus is coming to those who are not getting any kind of false redemption here on the planet. Those are the people who are the most drawn to Christ. I mean, when you, it's the sort of rich young ruler idea that often in our strategy in evangelical America, what we want to do is say, hey, you can have everything the rich young ruler has too, right? I mean, somebody like Joel Osteen out of Houston, who I actually have a lot of respect for because his church is so diverse and he's such an optimistic guy. But he does say, you can have your best life now. You can live your best life now if you just have Jesus. I don't think that that's true. And there's a couple reasons. One is, when I look at pre-fallen man, the characteristic that Moses wants us to understand about pre-fallen man is very simple. And there's only one. Pre-fallen man, and Moses says it 7 times in Genesis 2 and 3, walked around naked and wasn't ashamed. In other words, he was in such an amazingly close relationship with God. God poured so much love through him that he was hardly self-aware. Hardly self-aware at all. He could walk around naked and not know it. I don't know about you guys, but when I'm naked, I know it. I always know when I'm naked. I'm never at the grocery store like, oh, I forgot my wallet. Oh, I forgot my clothes. That never, ever happens. So this isn't even a kind of reality that we can even understand, right? It's so completely foreign to us. And we will not understand this reality until we are reunited with the Trinity. It will not happen for you here on the planet. It won't. You will not live your best life now. It's theologically impossible. You will live it when you are reunited with the Trinity. And so when we invite people into a relationship with Jesus, we invite them to be engaged to Christ and reunited with God, either when he comes back or when we go and be with him. We invite them into hope, a really hopeful life. So next time you're reading a kind of a self-help Christian book, and it says you can live your best life now, or you can be made complete in God, that's another favorite, or you can be the person that God designed you to be. Have you ever heard that? Be the person God designed you to be. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what you want to do is you want to flip to the end of the book, and look at the author's picture, and if the author has clothes on, you want to close the book and put it back on the shelf because they don't know what they're talking about. Only trust naked authors. Yeah. And so thanks for having me. Good night. Yeah, one of the reasons that Christ is so difficult to recognize in our culture is because he isn't offering people what they really want. He's offering them what they really, really want. He's not offering people a coping mechanism. He's offering them what they really need. He's not offering people a numbness for their pain. He's offering people a passage through their pain. He's not offering people a great, easy life. Where do we get these ideas? We get them from sort of free market dynamics. Can you imagine like the Apostle Paul on a late night infomercial pitching the product of Jesus? I mean, you're just flipping through the channels and then you come across Paul and you say, "Hi, I'm Paul, and I want to tell you about the product of Jesus. I used to have a job, and I had lots of money, and I had friends, and I had power, and if I disagree with you, I would kill you. And I called this 1-800 number, and I got the product of Jesus, and I was blinded for 3 days. Doctor's warning comes up at the bottom, may cause temporary blindness. I lost my job, I lost my friends, and I was routinely beaten and imprisoned and bitten by snakes. You too can have Jesus if you just call toll-free 1-800, right?" Yeah, for some reason it doesn't work. And how we've switched that into you can sort of have your best life now or things can be great is a complete mystery to me. There's nothing in the text that would signify you could do that. All of that is because you as an American encounter 3,000 commercial messages a day that sell you lies. And so when we translate our theology using the filter of those lies, we translate it into these ideas that you can have everything right now. It's just not a biblical idea. It's almost impossible to read the text, find it. But what does it do to you as a human being? It really jacks you up because you have an enormous number of false expectations. And then if you're not happy and you have Jesus, whose fault is that? Jesus' fault? No, it's not Jesus. It's your fault. You're doing it wrong. You're doing the religious formula wrong. So then what are you? You're just miserable and depressed all the time rather than understanding, no, this life is really hard and Christ is our hope. And Christ is the hope that is within us. This is our hope. It's Jesus and he is within us. So we play this sort of game in evangelical culture that rather than presenting that message, we want to associate ourselves or we get really excited when people who are kind of winning in the world system of false redemption begin to identify themselves with Jesus. That gets us really excited. Remember this guy? Here, show the next slide. Remember when this guy was like big on the thing? And we were so excited, right? Because Braveheart is now making a movie about Jesus, right? And I mean, people just went nuts. Did people go nuts here? We went kind of nuts in the Pacific Northwest. They were just really, really excited. And then go to the next slide. And then when he went crazy, we disassociated like mad, right? Because now he hates Jews and something's really weird and he always smells like whiskey. And nobody wants to associate him anymore. And go to the next slide. Why? Because that Jesus isn't helping us win. And this is the new kind of the new one. Go to this slide. Now I'm going to really offend some people. I'm in the wrong part of the country, right? And enormous amount. I think TiVo is like 23 years old, a devout believer, obviously a man of great faith, but probably not the most mature faith, right? I mean, there's something when my friends watch him, we go, wow, you know, he's really trying to be the most popular kid in the youth group. Am I stepping on toes? Where are the back exits, Mike? Are they? Yeah. Yeah. I want him to put the Bible verse under his thing that says, when you pray, go into your inner closet and pray in secret to your Father, who, and then kind of people would just be confused, right? By that. See, in 25 years, these jokes will be really funny. So where have I seen Jesus? Where do I see hope on the planet? I want to give you a few examples, and some of them are going to seem really odd. The first place that I've seen Jesus here is in this guy. His name is Tom Ritchie. And a friend introduced me to Tom and said, "Tom's coming to Portland. His kids live in Portland. He'd love to go on a bike ride with you." So I'm just sort of an amateur cyclist, and Tom and I went for a ride, and I got a flat tire on the ride. and I started to kind of fix the tire, and Tom kind of stepped in and said, hey, can I take care of this? And he turned my bike over, and in 60 seconds, he had the tire off, the tube out, the new tire in, blown up, back on the bike. In under 60 seconds, my tire was blown up and back. And I just went, who are you again? So we went to this pub, I mean coffee shop. We went to this, and we were having coffee. Cold pints of coffee. And Tom told me his story. He invented the mountain bike in the 70s. He has a company called Ritchie Logic. So if you're a cyclist and you check your handlebars when you go home, it may say Ritchie Logic on it. Those are Tom's handlebars. He now specializes in kind of the cockpit of these upscale bikes. And he told me his story. He said, you know, Don, my company was going crazy, millions and millions of dollars, operated it out of Sweden. He lives in San Francisco. And he would fly his own personal jet around the world. He'd fly his own jet everywhere, right? And he flew home one night, and his house was empty. His wife cleaned it out and left him a note that just said, I'm gone. You're never here anyway, so it doesn't matter. And he hit rock bottom. I mean, he lost his family. He thought he'd lost his kids. And he sat in his home, and he read Christian self-help books for like 2 years. And finally, one of his friends said, Tom, you can't do this. You can't live like this. You know, you're going to die in this empty house. I mean, just sit on the floor with no furniture. And they said, Tom, come with us to Rwanda. And we're just going to go on this trip to Rwanda, going to meet some people. Tom was like, okay, I'll go. I can't sit around here forever. He flies to Rwanda, post-genocide, like my friend who was there. And he meets these people who have forgiven each other of the most extreme atrocities. And he realizes, what if I can be forgiven of the things that I've done? And he learns from these people the possibilities of hope and joy that exist in the world. And he does an amazing thing. He actually turns around and he says, you know what? I don't care if my company goes bankrupt, because they were going bankrupt because they had no leadership. And Tom said, everything in my life, all the horrible things that have happened, all the learning how to make bikes have come down to this. And he noticed these bikes that were imported from India, these very heavy bikes that only have one gear, and they're trying to climb these giant hills with them, and they're loading hundreds of pounds of coffee on the back of these bikes, and they're using them like dollies. And Tom said, I can invent a bike. I can engineer a bike that would save Rwanda. And so he started making a bike with a longer wheelbase that has a platform on the back. You can actually get these bikes at REI now. They've become so popular, but Tom is the one who created them. And you can put a hundred or so pounds of coffee on the back of this bike. Then it has three or four gears so you can climb these hills. And he sent over 100,000 of them into Rwanda. And he sat here and he told me, he said, Don, we need to get 1 million bikes into Rwanda so that India doesn't start shipping cheap cars in, because as soon as there's an automobile in Rwanda, it'll further marginalize the poor in that country. And so he has this vision. He doesn't care anymore about his own company. And each time he talks about it, he's like, Don, Jesus has designed me for this purpose. Jesus is inside me, and Jesus is saving Rwanda through me. He believes this. I mean, he just has that much faith, not in himself, but in Christ. And now, he's on the cover of Outside Magazine, and all these people are doing stories on Project Rwanda. And so Tom's company is going crazy now. So and they don't even want him in the office. They're like, go out and do Jesus things, and we will sell handlebars, because whatever you're doing is really great. And Tom's life has been completely revolutionized. Another guy that I met where I saw Jesus is really going to surprise you. It's this guy. You'll recognize him. He used to be the head coach at USC. He won 36 straight games and 2 national titles, and he's now the head coach of the Seattle Seahawks. And I saw a little 60 Minutes episode where Pete Carroll was coaching at USC and then driving into the inner city in Los Angeles in the middle of the night because he'd heard some radio stories about gang violence that was taking place. And so Pete was like, I'm going. And he gets in his car, he goes in the inner city, he gets out, he goes up to some kids on the street at midnight, and he says, hey, can you tell me anything about Crips and Bloods and how all that works? I kid you not, he did this. And he would do this like every couple nights while he was a coach. And nobody knew for years that he was doing it until a reporter with the Los Angeles Times caught wind of it and trailed him and wrote a story about it. And then 60 Minutes came in and said, we want to cover this. So they brought it. Anyway, he started an organization called A Better LA that made a ton of money. And I was always curious, why would a guy who's so successful risk his life to go into the inner city? Like, what motivates a guy to do that? And honestly, I was thinking, is Pete a believer? I mean, it just doesn't seem like that, right? So I go to the New Orleans-Seattle game last year, that playoff game that Seattle won. Remember that? And I'm there, and I tweet, and I'm watching Pete Carroll pace the sidelines, and it's killing me. I mean, I got to know, why when you were in L.A. did you go into the interstate? And he's busy, so I can't, like, go down and ask him, you got a minute? So I send out a tweet that just says, if anybody knows Pete Carroll, I really want to talk to him. And I get this response when the playoffs ended, and Pete said, I'll give you 15 minutes. So I drove to Seattle from Portland to get my 15 minutes with Pete Carroll, right? We ended up talking for like 2.5 hours. It was the most fascinating conversation I had last year. Pete is not a believer. He's agnostic. He grew up Catholic. He left as soon as he could. He's never returned back to faith. But as he talked about why he was going into the inner city, why he was doing these things, there was a very spiritual element to what he was talking about. And I asked him, I said, Pete, do you believe in God? He said, no. I mean, God may exist, but I have no proof. Therefore, you know, I don't believe. And I said, but you're doing all these things. And then we kind of changed subjects. And I said, Pete, you've had an unbelievably successful life. Like, has anybody helped you? And then he just kind of got quiet. He goes, okay, well, I'll speak to you frankly. He said, have you seen the movie The Adjustment Bureau with Matt Damon? And it involves Matt Damon is supposed to become president someday. And so there's sort of like angelic God figures who are opening and closing doors and making sure that his path. He goes, Don, my life feels like that. I said, what do you mean it feels like that? He said, it feels like there's some power that is opening doors for me. And I said, like, do you mean to become successful, to win a Super Bowl? He goes, no, I don't think it cares about that. Like, what does it care about? He goes, it just cares about loving people. And I'm just like... He goes, do you understand what I mean? I go, yeah, I vaguely understand what you mean. Well, wonderful, wonderful conversation. Then at the very end of the conversation, I kid you not, I'm getting ready to go. I have to go. Like who walks out on Pete Carroll? It's like, I gotta go. We've been here for 2.5 hours, and I got another thing. And so Pete's like, hey, before you go, I just got to tell you this. I promise you he said this. He said, if somebody could come to me and tell me all truth, I would follow him. I said, Pete, what did you say? He said, Don, I don't know what I mean, but if somebody came to me and told me they could tell me all truth, and he pointed at the clock on the wall by his door, and he said, I would leave my wife and children, and I would leave this job in under 1 second, and I would follow him. I'm like, I think I know a guy, you know? I mean, that's Pete's journey, but I see Jesus operating in the world in such beautiful, beautiful ways. So much so that anymore... whatever you want to call it, evangelism no longer looks to me like the sharing of information. I don't tell people about Jesus by saying, here are some truths about Christ. What I do is I set them up on a blind date with Jesus and hope they hit it off. Because he exists. He's a being. He can interact with people. And so I just say, hey, read through this passages in John or read through this book and see if you and Jesus kind of hit it off. And I'd love to answer any questions if he freaks you out. Right? And people actually have these real... So I'm not convincing anybody of any kind of real theological truths. That may come later, but what I'm just doing is saying, Jesus exists. I have a... And what happens, I think, with a lot of us is we have this sort of mysterious encounter with Christ. It's a relational encounter. It doesn't make a lot of sense to us. It didn't make a lot of sense to us when it happened. And then we get a Christian education, and we learn the rational truths that took place, right? And then we assume that if we share with people the rational truths that we use to justify our experience, they will have the experience that we had without the rational truths in the first place. It's not true. No, what they need to just meet Jesus, right? I can't tell you how many, there's been a couple really great conversations this year with Muslims, with friends who are Muslims, who all they want to talk about is this new relationship that they have with Jesus. And they have no idea they are Christians. None. No clue. They wouldn't, if you told them they were Christians, they would say, no, I'm Muslim. But there's no question they have a relationship with Christ. Because we are not saved through right theology. Is there right theology? Yes, there is right theology. But we are not saved through right theology. We are saved through Christ. Does that make sense? do you hate me? So what we do is we bring people Jesus. I want to fast forward a little bit to one last story. We'll get to some of these slides tomorrow. Go all the way to the couple standing in front of the lodge. You see that slide? I don't know what number slide it is. Probably the main person in the last several years who I've seen Jesus in is this guy. His name is Bob Goff, and that is his wife, Sweet Maria. He calls his wife Sweet Maria. I met Bob, 5 years ago maybe, kayaking on that inlet. That lodge looks really great, right? That is the only structure within 50 miles. So Bob built this. He dynamited the side of a mountain. There is a Young Life camp that it's connected to, but even the Young Life camp gets its electricity off of a creek, and there's no other electricity within 50 miles. And my friends and I had kayaked back in this inlet in Canada. It took us about 4 days to get back here. And here's this, like, monstrosity of a structure, right? And this guy, Bob Goff, comes bumbling down the stairs, and he yells out, "Are you guys hungry?" Well, we're pretty hungry, and we smell like sewage, and that place looks like it's got a flushing toilet. So we're like, we're a lot of things, including hungry. And we come up. Sweet Maria puts out this whole buffet of fresh fruit. Now, the only way to get food to this place is you fly it in on a float plane, right? So food is pretty, there's no 7-Eleven. Food is pretty scarce. And I'm kind of going, where in the world, what is this? Like, we came here to get away from everything, and we find this house and this guy. And Bob ends up telling us the story of how the lodge was built. He basically is a lawyer. He's a construction lawyer. So he sues companies that make really massive skyscrapers when they're crooked. And he makes millions and millions of dollars every year. And he does things for the kingdom with the money. And he and Maria, I don't know if they're still doing this. They were doing this before. At the end of the year, they would take all the money that they made and they would do something. They would build a school in Uganda, or they would, and then whatever money is left over, they give it all away. So at the end of every year, they have no dollars. They are completely and totally broke. And then they just say, "Jesus, if you want to give us more money, we'd love to do it again. That was a blast." And then Bob is a shrewd lawyer. He's never lost a case. And he goes out and he makes millions and millions of more dollars. And he's just a fascinating guy. So I asked, why this lodge in the middle of nowhere? He said, "Well, Maria and I do this work in Uganda. We fell in love with Uganda, and we started building schools there just off of construction money. Nobody gave any money to Bob. He just did it all with his own money. He built these schools, and because he's a lawyer, he would go visit members of the judiciary, because if you go to Uganda, you can pretty much just walk into the judiciary and talk to the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. It's not like America, right? You just walk in and say hi." And so Bob became friends with them. And then they loved Bob so much, they made him the American consul. They made him Uganda's primary American lawyer. So Bob is a diplomat. He has a card, Mike. He has a card. He can speed, and they can't give him a ticket. I'm not kidding. If that's not worth becoming a diplomat, I'm looking for some country that I can manipulate into making me their consul or their writer in residence. I'll take anything to get that card. And the reason is, wherever Bob is, he's in Uganda. So if Bob were here, we would be in Uganda. And so nobody could touch us because Bob is Uganda. And pretty cool, huh? And he becomes the American consul. And he comes home and he tells his kids he's the American consul and he's going to have to meet with all these diplomats. And they say, "What does that mean?" And Bob's like, "I don't know. What would you say if you met with a diplomat?" And the children were just small at this time. They're all in college now. That they said, "I would want to ask him what they hope in, and I would want to videotape the interview in which Lindsay asked him what they hope in." And then the youngest, Adam, said, "I'd want to invite them over for a sleepover." So Bob is kind of a wild hare. He and Maria got 2,500 pieces of stationery and wrote to every leader in the world and asked them if they wanted to come over for a sleepover so that Lindsay could ask what they hope in and Richard could videotape it. Well, nobody could come over for a sleepover. They were busy. But 29 of them wrote back and said, "You can come to us and we'll grant the interview." So Bob pulls his kids out of school and he flies them to 28 countries to interview 29 world leaders to ask what they hope in. And they end up making wonderful family friends with all these people. And they just want, Bob, if you know Bob, he just wants to talk about Jesus all the time. Everywhere he goes, he just talks about Jesus. He doesn't talk about theology or doctrine or that. He just wants to talk about Jesus. And they all fall in love with him. And Bob realizes, man, my new friends, they can't really come to my house in San Diego. They have a small house in San Diego. They can't come there. But if we built a lodge, every year we could bring all these world leaders in and we could do peace summits surrounded by the idea of Jesus. So Bob built this lodge, and every year world leaders come to a construction lawyer's lodge, and then Bob writes up a peace treaty based on the ideas of Jesus, and they all sign it so that they won't go to war with each other. Isn't that pretty cool? Yeah. Don't you love it when we don't depend on some kind of church program to bring Jesus into the world? We just go, oh, wait, Jesus is with me. He's in me. I'll go. I don't got to bring Mike. I don't got to bring my pastor. I'll just bring Jesus. And Jesus and I will go, and we will change the world. So Bob is over in Uganda. This happened. This all happened this year, the story that I'm going to tell you. It ended 2 months ago. Bob is over in Uganda, and he realizes that there are these witch doctors in rural villages in Uganda who are abducting children and doing live sacrifices on these kids. They're killing these kids in ceremonies. And what they're doing is they're cutting off their private body parts and selling them to contractors who bury them in the corners of buildings to bring good luck to the building. So they'll cut off a young boy's genitals and bury them in the corner of this building. Bob finds out about this, and he says, well, we've got to do something. I mean, I'm the American consul. What can I do? I know people in jiu-jitsu. He goes back, and he says, what can we do? And he finds out, well, there is a UN convention that is against the trafficking of human body parts. And so he pressures Parliament to ratify this UN convention. And then he's got to pressure Parliament. And this is a white guy construction lawyer who just takes Jesus places, right? Now he's got to pressure Parliament to pass a law in Uganda against the trafficking of human body parts. So he can't do it. He doesn't have enough power to do it. So what he does, he just calls John Ashcroft, the attorney general at the time, who has no idea who Bob is. Somehow he gets through because they have mutual friends. And John Ashcroft says, what can I help you with? And he says, well, Uganda this, Uganda that, but I need some like presence on the ground in Uganda in order to get them to pass this law. Will you come with me to Uganda? Ashcroft says, I'm in. He jumps on a plane, and they go meet with Ugandan Parliament. This is a picture of, you'll see John Ashcroft at the bottom middle. That's Ralph Ochan, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Bob is on the right side there with the red tie. And that is members of Parliament who passed this law against the trafficking of human body parts. Now, it's against the law for witch doctors to abduct kids, but they're still doing it. And so Bob said, what can we do? They said, well, now we have to actually take a case to court to ratify this law. And Bob meets a kid named Kai. Last year, in 2011, Kai was abducted by witch doctors and had his genitals cut off in a ceremony where they left him to die. And Kai stood up and said, I will not die today. And he walked back into his village. And he lived. And Bob meets Kai and is just captivated, falls in love with this kid. He has since adopted him. And so he goes back to the judiciary and he says, we've got our case. We've got the kid. He's a witness. We know George Kabi is the witch doctor who did it. We can bring this in front of court. And Ralph Ochan said, Bob, you know we will be killed. I mean, that's why we don't try witch doctors. We haven't really wanted to tell you that because you've been so optimistic about this whole process. And Bob looked at Ralph and said, Ralph is a believer. Ralph knows Jesus. And Bob said, Ralph, wouldn't Jesus die for Roderick? Aren't you willing to die for Roderick? I'll try the case. You preside over the case. We'll get the work done. And if we're killed, we're killed. Can you believe that? I mean, he's like, Jesus is in me, and Jesus has proven he's willing to die. Let's go. And Ralph said, you're right. Let's do it. So they bring George Kabi into the courtroom, and Bob is texting me from the courtroom, Don, I am staring into the face of evil. My friend John Niemeyer works with Bob on the ground in Uganda, and they bought this brand new camera because they wanted to record the trial, right, to get the video out around Uganda saying, look, any witch doctors who do this, this is what happens now. So they bring this new camera, and they focus it on George Kabi. George turns and looks into the lens of the camera, and the mirrors in the camera fall out. And Bob just freaks out. He's like, where are we? What kind of evil are we dealing with, right? They go through with the case, and for the first time in the history of Uganda, a witch doctor is put into prison for trafficking in human body parts. So George will spend the rest of his life in prison, and the bad guy goes down. Then Bob goes back to Uganda. Show the next slide. He goes back to Uganda, and he meets with 30 more witch doctors. He does a big kind of banquet in this hotel room. He brings them gifts. He brings them like stuffed animals because he wants to come in kindness and say, you can't kill kids anymore in Uganda. Ralph Ochan is there. Ralph says, look, anybody who does this, Bob's going to preside over the case. Bob's going to be the prosecution. I'm going to preside over the case. You're going to spend the rest of your life in prison. Now, if that's not amazing enough, the story gets even better. I mean, when Jesus does things, he really does things, right? There's a doctor in L.A. named Randy Sherman. He's head of surgery at Cedars-Sinai. A brilliant, brilliant guy. And Randy and Harrison Ford fly into rural countries and do surgeries on people when nobody's looking. And nobody really talks about it, but he and Harrison Ford would go into Haiti, and they did like 600 traumas. He's like, Harrison Ford, hand me a scalpel. Yes. Weird. So he's a really, really neat guy, but he and Harrison Ford are just plane junkies. They love airplanes. And Bob flies a Beaver. It's a float plane. It's a big float plane that he can land on the water outside of his lodge. It's just a hobby of his. And Randy wants to learn to fly one of these float planes. So he goes up to Seattle, and he's practicing touch and goes on one of Kenmore Air's float planes. And his training pilot is a woman named Karen, who's a really good friend of ours, longtime friend of Bob's. Well, Karen happened to have been in Uganda when they met Kai. And so Randy says, whose lodge is that? Like 50 miles from the nearest anything. What is this? And Karen said, well, actually, that's my friend Bob. And we were just in Uganda. We met this kid named Kai. And Kai had his genitals cut off. So Randy lands the plane. He turns off the engine. And he says, I'm sorry, what happened? And she said, well, he had his genitals cut off. It's this thing that they used to do in Uganda. And Randy said, Karen, do you know I'm the world's leading expert on creating and attaching penises? She goes, no, I didn't. That's never come up. Yeah, it's absolutely true. Randy Sherman, this is, all the guys in the room are going, can the ladies leave because I'm very curious how this works. Can you get the parts at Home Depot? Do you get to choose like what it looks like? Many, many jokes. Randy says, I can fix Kai. I know how. I can fix him. He's 8 years old. No problem. And so Randy, here's a picture of Randy. Now, as soon as I heard this, I got on a plane and flew to L.A. because I got to meet the guy who makes penises. I have lunch with Randy. This is taken with my iPhone. This is Randy drawing how to make a penis out of a forearm on a napkin. And I keep this napkin in my briefcase, and I'm always afraid somebody's going to pull it out and go, Don Miller's a pervert. Look at him drawing on a cocktail napkin. Yeah, so Randy raises the $50,000 necessary to do the surgery. Bob flies back over to Uganda, becomes Kai's legal guardian, brings him back to the United States. He's actually still here. And about 8 Tuesdays ago, had his surgery done. And as Bob says, Kai has nothing to be ashamed of on the playground. He's doing great. We actually made a few phone calls. Kai got a secret tour of the Oval Office. And, you know, I mean, talk about going from emasculated and left to die to, you know, to being in the presence of the most powerful man in the world. It's really a wonderful, wonderful story. And this is, go to the next slide. This is Bob. He's just such a joyful guy. This is actually Bob's office. Bob offices at a picnic table on Treasure Island at Disneyland. I'm not kidding. If Bob gives you a business card as a high-powered lawyer and as the American consul from Uganda, it doesn't say any of that. You know what it says? It says, Bob Goff, helper, Treasure Island. I've had meetings with the Supreme Court of Uganda at that picnic table, looking across, and they have Mickey Mouse ears, and the Chief Justice actually had one that said, Chief. And we would sit and talk business. And so Bob takes Kai to Disneyland, and he's doing great. He actually goes home in March. There's been a little bit of complications. He'll have to have some stuff worked on by Randy, but he'll go back in March. But Bob called and just said, Don, you know, Jesus did this amazing thing. Kai has two full-time bodyguards, an 8-year-old with 2 full-time bodyguards in Uganda. So when he goes home, he actually has guys walking around with machine guns because the witch doctors want to get him, you know, for what he represents to their their culture. And so there's still a lot of hopelessness in the midst of all this. So Jesus coming in and bringing hope into this hopeless situation. So Bob calls and he says, "Don, amazing story. Loved kind of living it with you and just seeing what Jesus was going to do. What an incredible year of just being Jesus in the world." And he said, "But Don, don't you get this feeling that the story is not resolved, that Jesus isn't done?" And I know exactly what he's talking about. And I just went, "Oh, Bob, are you being serious?" He goes, "I am." You know who he's talking about? He's talking about Cobby, the witch doctor, who's going to die in prison. And he's just like, "Jesus isn't done." So Bob gets back on a plane, and he flies back to Uganda, and he gets a translator, and he goes to the maximum security prison where Cobby is housed. And he described it as this dark, desolate place. No windows, and one small door, about the size that you would build a door maybe for a dog. And in a prison designed to house about 100 people, there are over 1,000. And they are slammed into this place. And amazingly, Bob gets a private room with George Cobby and the translator. And Cobby comes in and he sees this lawyer who put him in prison. And he falls to his knees and he just says, "I am so sorry." And Bob says, "Cobby, what has happened to you?" And Bob confessed he was a little angry. He didn't want to go to Cobby and speak to Cobby because Cobby hurt his friend. But Bob said this to me. He said, "You know, Don, Jesus will go places I don't want to go, and Jesus will forgive people I don't want to forgive. I just have to get Jesus there." Isn't that great? I just have to get Jesus there. He's capable of forgiving people I can't forgive. He's capable of loving people I can love. I just need to get Jesus into the room. So Bob goes, and he has this two-hour conversation with George. And he talks about how they both do spiritual work. And the spiritual work that Bob does, he does for Jesus. And has Cobby ever heard of Jesus? And Bob tells Cobby about Jesus. And then Bob says, "You know, when you came and you came into the room and you knelt down, you asked me to forgive you. I can forgive you, but this does nothing in your life." He said, "But if Jesus forgives you, you will have hope in the next life. You will be reunited with him." And so by the end of the conversation, Bob grabs George Cobby's hand and they bow, and with the translator there, they pray. And George Cobby, the witch doctor, is now your brother in Christ. Christ is in George. This is the last picture that Bob got in the prison. And what an incredibly beautiful story. I mean, what a hopeful story in the midst of so little hope. And what a dignified man this is now. What an amazing calling that he would be able to say, "You know what? Christ used me to teach an entire country not to hurt these children. Christ used me to change the law." I mean, if I ever get to meet George, and I actually believe I will meet George, probably this year. If I get to meet George, I want to say to him, "What Christ has done through you, you may be one of the most important people in all of Uganda. Christ, what Christ has done in your story and through your story. That you would sit here and be a martyr for him in this prison. You should do that with honor and dignity. And you will be reunited with Christ. And I will introduce you to all these people from Charlotte, North Carolina, who are your brothers," right? It's going to be a really neat day, I think. So my question to us is, as leaders, are we bringing Christ into our neighbor's house? Are we bringing Christ into our house? Right? Do we understand that Christ is within us? Or are we looking externally for Tim Tebow to bring Christ to our culture? For Mel Gibson to bring Christ to our culture? Let's not do that. He's within us. And he is within us. It's him. It's the real Jesus, incarnate, inside of you, bringing hope into the world. Let's close in prayer. Jesus, I'm so grateful that you have included us in this story that you're telling the world. That you have put yourself within us, enmeshed yourself within us, within our voices, within our personalities. That you are really here with your power, and that you can go into the lives of our neighbors, and you can go with us into our workplaces, and you can go with us and bring hope to our hopeless friends, and bring hope to our hopeless lives. In Jesus' name, amen.
Let's thank God.